You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is the Sunday, April 11th, 1999 edition of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. I'm your host, Robert Norse. 2.5 hours of civil rights talk, concerns about police misconduct, a bit of a focus on the bombing of Serbia and the misery going on over there. Some analysis of the sleeping ban, sort of the diet you're used to on Bathrop's Piers Broadsides, so stay tuned. Stay with us. Looks like we have a phone call.
Hi, you're on the air on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
And looks like that caller didn't want to be on the air. Caller, call back in a few moments, or you can always try, if you're calling into our show, the Huff Line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. That's 423-4833 if you want to make comments off the air. We usually have a producer standing by, but unfortunately the producer is bedridden at the moment, recovering from some heavy seasonal illness, you know how that is. So just give us a wait about 2 or 3 minutes before you call into the studio line, but we're usually hot here on the line, 427-3772, or if you want to leave a message, you can try 423-HUFF, 423-4833. So as I said, we're going to be running through lots of stuff today, and I'm a little behind the time. What I'm going to do to begin with, to kind of segue us into this, is play you an interview that happened about half a month ago, with Jane Hagstrom. Jane is an activist from Santa Barbara who now heads, actually, the whole psychiatric ward. I guess she went crazy, so now she's kind of examining and taking care of other crazy people, if that's the way to put it, up in Berkeley at Alta Bates Hospital. And she really was quite a player in the Santa Barbara scene for about 10 years. She was there when Santa Barbara homeless gained the right to vote for homeless people. She was ahead of the Homeless Coalition. She wasn't herself homeless, but she was a person who wrote a lot of grants for them. Very well-educated woman, did her Ph.D., on the successful fight to end the Santa Barbara sleeping ban. And we're going to hear her talking about issues that are really very important that you heard discussed with Mike Rotkin and David Silva, Councilmember Rotkin and activist Silva, last session of Bathrop's Piers Broadsides. And those issues were, of course, why not make it legal for homeless people to sleep, or why keep it criminal for folks to sleep? They're already getting rained on, they're already getting beaten up, they're already getting harassed. They already suffer the usual debilitating effects of poverty and the problems that go with it. Why are you, in fact, criminalizing a very important and essential human function, sleeping? And one of the reasons given by Councilmember Rotkin was his continued claim that if people were allowed to sleep, everybody in a two-state radius would come running in, or certainly lots and lots of people, and that would result in our current social climate supposedly favorable to homeless people turning unfavorable, social services being defunded, and so forth. The fact that this hasn't happened in areas where sleeping bans have been repealed has not been of particular significance to Councilmember Rotkin, who continues to put out the same line. And really, that's something that we need to discuss in greater detail, and I wish we'd gone into it in more detail in the debate, and hopefully Mike will be coming back for chapter two, or round two, I should say, of this debate. Right now, however, let's roll into this discussion with Jane Hagstrom of Santa Barbara. And I want to encourage you to stay tuned, because in the studio with us, we have Edward DeBolt, who is himself spoken to me at some length about concerns and problems he's had around police misconduct in Santa Cruz. And I'm going to kind of check the mic levels and so forth. And while I do that, we're going to hear this first interview with Jane Hagstrom. But don't go away. We actually have a real live person, and you can actually call in and talk to Mr. DeBolt here on the air to get his perspective on issues. He's been around Santa Cruz for 20 years, more or less. He's a man who's been on the streets and off the streets and seems pretty street smart, and he's got some interesting things to say. But first, let's hear from Jane Hagstrom, who is also very articulate, and as I said, did her PhD thesis, and is a long struggle to get the sleeping ban repealed in Santa Barbara, which it was for 3 years before the Santa Barbara City Council, seeing Mitch Snyder dead, the national homeless activist, and his threat to bring everybody to Santa Barbara and protest gone, then they reimposed the sleeping ban, a very low blow to the homeless people in their community. Let's hear this debate. I mean, let's hear this analysis from Jane Hagstrom.
And we have our favorite bleeding heart on the phone, that woman who's not only working with folks as a psychiatric supervisor. I'm not sure. What is your position up there in Berkeley, Jane?
Care manager.
You're what?
I'm a patient care manager.
You are, of course, Jane Hagstrom, who headed the Santa Barbara Homeless Coalition for a number of years in the 80s down in Santa Barbara. Are you not?
Yes, that is who I am.
That is, in fact, who you really are. And did you not also write your PhD thesis on the struggle to abolish the sleeping ban in Santa Barbara?
Right.
That was quite a long thesis.
100 pages, I guess.
How many?
That's 600.
600.
Yeah.
And
pretty proficient typist as a result.
Indeed. And have many other skills as well. Let me ask you, what do you think, what came out of that project for you? If you were to summarize the significant factors that caused the sleeping ban to be repealed in Santa Barbara in 1986, what were they?
Well, it was the threat of a mass march, a mass protest movement. Thousands of homeless people march on Santa Barbara to go to sleep. And the specter for Santa Barbara of having thousands of homeless people converging upon Santa Barbara to go to sleep, be arrested for sleeping, go to jail, clog up the court, come out of the jail, go back to sleep ad infinitum was terrifying to the population of Santa Barbara, or at least the lawmakers.
Mm-hmm.
So, they actually repealed the sleeping ban because of the protest that was being planned in conjunction with the Center for Creative Nonviolence in Washington, D.C., and Mitch Snyder and his crew it was very palpable, it was very real. There was a lot of organization going on with homeless in L.A. that were going to be marching, homeless coming from Washington. We were going to be marching on Santa Barbara, and we had a number of national leaders like Jesse Jackson who were involved, Jackson Brown, John Voight, nationally known people were all kind of involved in the Santa Barbara fray, and the media attention to the whole issue was simply too hot for the city council to be able to respond to as far as ban.
Now, part of that media attention sprung from the fact that the summer White House was in Santa Barbara.
Yeah.
Reagan had a ranch there.
Yeah, Reagan had a ranch over Refugio Canyon, which is about 20 minutes north of Santa Barbara. So he would actually spend quite a bit of time in Santa Barbara, and the press corps would be sitting around on a regular basis downtown at the Sheraton Hotel with nothing to do. So we regularly fed them stories for the national media.
Mm-hmm.
Our homeless folks were appearing on TV with stories about their dogs or...
Now, you also had some financial angels like Kit Tremaine, right?
Yeah. Actually, Kit gave us a little bit of seed money, not a whole lot, about $5,000 to organize, to hire an organizer. And from there, the organizer then was able to get letters and funding and wrote grants. You know, but getting that initial seed money was very helpful.
And you also had an established organization called the Homeless People's Association, which had really been kind of active at the local level for about 3 or 4 years before 1986, right?
Yeah, well, you know, the Santa Barbara Coalition on the Homeless Coalition, was an interesting group. Because what it was, it was a group that, unlike a lot of task force that get set up to assist homeless people, you know, a lot of these agencies will get together and, you know, you have non-homeless people determining what the homeless need. In the case of Santa Barbara, we had a very active homeless population that was very, very involved in participating in the decision-making about programs, about goals, about what sort of solutions were needed. So there was a great deal of homeless input and a lot of homeless activism on the part of the people. And so, you know, we had the homeless perspective, and I think that because the homeless were so vocal and so active and so present in many, many debates, many meetings, and the politicians started seeing these people as human beings. You know, you can't sit next to someone in a meeting or in a task force for, you know, day after day after day without forming some sort of relationship. So I think because the city council members, the mayor and so on, were getting to know the homeless people quite well, it made a difference.
There was also a series of violent attacks on homeless people the year before, in 1985 and 1984, right?
Well, there were violent attacks that lasted for years, and they also lasted after the ban was lifted. But, there were murders of homeless people. There were vigilantes that were sending out threatening letters, "You're next, you know, this guy's murdered, and I'm going to get you next." That's bottles of arsenic laced wine, and you know, that were set out for homeless people to drink. You know, these wine bottles with glass inside were found. Pretty unpleasant.
And you also had the university, nearby university from Isla Vista, and social service providers involved in pressuring the city council.
Well, that was, I think, one of the most remarkable things about that whole movement is how there was a certain idealism that developed around, a lot of people coalesced around this issue. I think there was a lot of, we had some people at UCSD who were very active internationally and nationally on affordable housing issues. Rich Applebaum, who was...
You mean UCSD or UCSB?
SP.
Like Santa Barbara.
Santa Barbara.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Rich Applebaum, for instance, was chair of the Department of Sociology, and he knew Mitch Snyder very well and had done some interesting work on affordable housing. And then there was a student who was doing his dissertation on the homeless. That was Rob Rosenthal, and he was really quite brilliant. We had Peter Marin, who was a nationally known author, got very taken up with the cause, and had also students at UCSD that were getting involved. We had a very active social service community that had a big heart, you know, like John Jameson from the Salvation Army, Alice Hassler, who was running Transition House. So a lot of different people that were very poignant and articulate took up the cause of the homeless. A lot of retired social workers with influence, like
Santa Barbara is a seaside and university community, somewhat bigger than Santa Cruz. I think you have about 70,000 or 80,000 people.
Yeah, but and then if you count Goleta though, which is really another extension of Santa Barbara and Isla Vista, that whole area, Goleta has another 70,000. Probably got 100,000.
And how many homeless people do you estimate were within that area?
About 3,000.
And do you think the homeless people organized themselves, and were they...
Oh, they absolutely organized themselves. Nancy McCready and Bob Hansen were leading, organized homeless back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that, actually that's still going on to some extent, although you still had a plea in the fall of 1998, last fall, in November, the sleeping ban was put on the agenda by a sort of a new group of homeless people, and Peter Marin, one of the people you mentioned, wrote about it for your local Street Spirit Bay Area homeless newspaper, mostly a younger group of homeless people eloquently asked the city council to find legal places for people to sleep, particularly considering the fact that, like in Santa Cruz and Santa Barbara, there's completely inadequate shelter for homeless people, and so they have nothing but to become illegal when they sleep at night. Was that the main focus back in 1986 as well?
My work on my dissertation, I mean, basically it's a ridiculous solution to the problem. It's a solution that makes the problem worse. You know, the expenditure of public funds to keep somebody in jail overnight is tremendous. I mean, you could put somebody up at the Hilton for the amount of money you spent putting someone in jail. The booking costs, time, the energy.
But taking the devil's advocate's point of view, Jane, wouldn't it also be ridiculous to suggest that people should sleep on the streets? I mean, we've had many a so-called progressive here in Santa Cruz running for political office saying, we must keep our camping ban and the sleeping ban sections of our camping ban because the homeless deserve affordable housing. We can't just let them sleep on the streets. That would provoke more hostility to them. That would provoke more people to defund services for the homeless. That's wrong. We can't do that. That's primitive. That's not suitable for an urban environment. What's your response to that?
Well, I mean, people have no choice but to sleep on the streets if there's lack of housing and shelter. I mean, say that, you know, this is not acceptable when you don't have alternative solutions. You know, it's like asking someone to stop breathing. You know, people have to sleep, for God's sakes, and, you know, it's just...
So in 1986, you had this movement. I remember that famous poster, Come to the Fig Tree, I think it was August 1st, go to sleep, go to jail, or some such thing. And it was, you know, everyone was being drawn to this beautiful, huge fig tree you used to have in Santa Barbara.
And we also had Gary Trudeau doing a whole series in the, you know, he's the one that does that part.
Oh, Doonesbury, yeah.
And he, you know, so, I mean, national attention was being brought to Santa Barbara.
So the city council surrendered and repealed the citywide sleeping ban ordinance.
Well, it was at the last moment. It was dramatic. It was very exciting, you know. It was just a few days before the march when the whole country was mobilizing its homeless people to converge on Santa Barbara. They finally voted to kill it. And what was interesting is when we first started working with the Homeless Coalition was formed in 19...
When was it formed?
Was formed around 1983.
Uh-huh.
And when the coalition first established itself, you know, we could call the mayor or call the city council or the city manager to try to get things on the agenda or just to talk to people about programs, and they would never call us back.
Mm-hmm.
However, when the heat was coming down with the homeless protests, I had the mayor calling me at home on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Call off the homeless. Call off the protest.
Ain't it always the way?
Yeah.
But now, I understand that they then repealed the sleeping ban sections of their camping ordinance, but did camping itself still remain illegal? I mean, could you put up a tent, or were you simply allowed to sleep? What was the outcome?
Camping was illegal.
What was that?
Camping had always been illegal in Santa Barbara.
Right, but did that change out in 1986?
No, that stayed the same. You could just now sleep.
So the camping ban itself was not repealed in Santa Barbara, just the sleeping sections of it. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true.
And I understand that several weeks later, when the heat was off, the city council came back and essentially removed the parks and the beaches from that so that people couldn't sleep in parks and beaches.
Well, there's the jungle.
There was that one undeveloped property, the jungle, that they allowed.
Well, then they came in and bulldozed it.
Right. Regularly, I understand.
Well, they did it pretty dramatically. This was a very thickly wooded area where the bushes and the trees were so thick right across the from Cabrillo Boulevard Beach that homeless people could sleep in there and no one would ever even see them. You wouldn't notice them.
What year did they bulldoze it? Do you remember?
And I can't quite remember, but I think it was after the sleeping ban was lifted.
I know that you then began to have protests at City Hall where people began to sleep regularly at City Hall. What were the objectives of those protests after the sleeping ban itself had been lifted, at least on public property, not in beaches or parks?
That was to get an adequate shelter.
So you were actually, so people were saying, we're here, see us, provide some shelter.
Yeah.
And what was the reaction of the city to that?
Well, the city was actually in the process of negotiating with some of the homeless folks, opening up some more shelter beds at La Casa de la Raza for families, mainly women. And, you know, I thought that the Homeless Coalition made a tactical mistake at that time with the guys mainly being opposed to negotiating around shelter and stopping they had quite a long sleeping protest at this.
And you may be thinking of 1990. I'm actually thinking of before that when the city council made an extra law, the Hamilton Law, the Don Hamilton Law, named after the famous activist who recently died, to make it illegal to sleep at City Hall.
Right. No, well, let me finish what happened.
Sure.
Yeah, I think what happened is the coalition actually got pretty good at providing programs, and we established a lot of social service programs for the homeless in Santa Barbara. We not only had this advocacy thing going on, but we also started running shelter programs, feeding food kitchens, medical transportation program, public health nursing outreach. We got a dental clinic going. We advocated to get free health care for the homeless at 4 or 5 different community health clinics. You know, I used to go and round everybody up every day and bring them out to county health care services to get their medical care taken care of. Now, it was really pretty impressive. And so what happened is we were running shelters, and the Homeless Coalition only employed homeless people to run their programs. I was the only non-homeless. I was the executive director. I did a lot of the administration and the hiring. Well, and we all actually participated in hiring people, but we hired homeless to run our program.
And the homeless themselves, for example, ran the Winter Armory shelter program?
Yes. Yes, they were the managers, the cooks, the janitors, everything, you know. So this was our model, and it put people to work, and it was great because a number of the homeless people that sort of got a taste of work again after having been employed for many years saw that they could do this, you know. It gave them a sense of self-esteem. We also worked real closely with some of the agencies that were providing the drug and alcohol services to people. So, people who were trying to kind of clean up their act, get clean and sober, were trying to, you know, get back to work. You know, we worked in numerous ways to, you know, try to get housing. They opened up a new hotel that I'm, I which hotel it was, but we were working closely with them. And, you know, people were developing a sense of self-esteem because they had, you know, they were getting back to work. And then what happened is the armory closed because the armory was weather dependent. And the same group of people that were active in running the armory, it's like now we're left without a whole lot to do as far as, you know, they formed this community of service to each other. And so they kind of moved the whole thing over to City Hall.
What year was this? Do you remember?
Oh, I cannot remember what year it was.
See, what I'm trying to do is give a sense. There's been a debate here in Santa Cruz about, yes, the sleeping ban was repealed in Santa Barbara for 3 years, and my understanding was in 1986 it was repealed. In 1989, a judge, sort of through a coup d'etat, ruled that sleeping is camping, and since camping was continuing to be illegal in Santa Barbara, sleeping also became illegal. And then in 1990, in the midst of a very long protest at City Hall, Bruce Rittenhouse, I don't think he was a city council member, but he was an active merchant, came forward with a proposal to make it illegal once more to sleep within a two-block corridor of State Street. And aspiring politician Hal Conklin expanded that proposal to cover the entire city, and the sleeping ban was reinstituted throughout Santa Barbara in 1990, partially as a bid to the 1990 elections, where Hal wanted to have an election issue. Does that comport with your understanding of what happened?
Yeah, but I think what happened around the reinstatement of the sleeping laws, actually Mitch Snyder also committed suicide in July of 1990, although some people was murdered by the CIA or the FBI, because he was certainly a pretty hot political figure. But with Mitch's, just the year before, Mitch had orchestrated a 300,000 person march on Washington, D.C. that was
Housing Now, as I remember.
Housing Now, it was fabulous. The music alone at that march was unbelievable. Jefferson Starship, Stevie Wonder, Tracy Chapman. It was a great day. It was a great thing that did. So he was certainly a formidable political character, and he used to come on a regular basis to Santa Barbara to support the homeless and protest Santa Barbara's spirited behavior towards homeless people. And
he would come to Santa Cruz as well, as I remember. He came in 1989 and spoke against the sleeping ban as well here.
And the anti-peeding thing in Santa Barbara was pretty, in Santa Cruz.
Yes, they were arresting people for serving soup at the town clock, soup without a permit.
Right. So at any rate, Mitch was involved in all that stuff, and I think that when Mitch died, a lot of the wind was taken out of the sails of the homeless movement on a national level, and, there was no one really there to fill the vacuum that could really step in and sort of, be so righteous a force on behalf of, doing the right thing and making the moral decision, And so I think it gave our city council a really opportune. I mean, it all happened around the same time.
It's true. They reinstated the sleeping ban, I believe, in July or August of 1990, about the time that the protest at City Hall began to fizzle out. I think you had a couple of busloads of people came up from L.A., and after that, their 3.5-month protest or whatever it was kind of went by the wayside.
Well, I think what happened with all protests is that, I think what happened is that it sort of lost its focus. It went from we need affordable housing, we need more shelter, we need year-round shelter. It started out with specific demands, and then it took on a life of its own where the protest actually became like a 24-hour. It was like a place where people would come out and hang out and play frisbee, and the kids would come, and people. It became a social. It took on a social family.
So we've been talking to Jane Hagstrom. Jane, any final words for us before we leave you hanging in the ether there?
Oh, just keep on. Being in people's faces, you just have to keep on being visible. You have to, one of the things that was also a highly successful strategy in Santa Barbara was the fact that we had a very expert team of legal advocates, lawyers, that were also working with us, and it remained funding the
Legal Defense Center.
Was very, very significant in bringing the legal arms.
We're gonna call you back to talk to you more about that, because I think it's important this information get to our city council, but we've got to go now. We've been talking to Jane Hagstrom, who is working up in Berkeley now with, what's the name of the place you're working at?
Alta Bates Hospital. I work with the mentally ill up here.
Well, we'll get back to you, Jane, and thanks for talking to us.
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
All right.
Sure. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. That was an interview with Jane Hagstrom of Berkeley now, then of Santa Barbara, a key player in the struggles down there that established homeless rights. And they're actually, even though the sleeping ban was resumed in Santa Barbara, the fighting against the sleeping ban has itself resumed. And we're going to, later in the show, hear an interview with Nancy McCready, actually the second part of an interview. We heard the first part a week or two ago, talking about a city council debate on the sleeping ban about the same time they were talking about the Santa Cruz sleeping ban up here. And it's interesting, the same kinds of issues, of course, come up in different cities and the same kind of arguments, pro and con. The question, though, of what the real substance is there any real truth to the claim that everybody in the world is going to come to a town that lifts the sleeping ban? Does it cause less sympathy for the homeless? Is it just sort of impossible for a city to do without risking anarchy and chaos or huge backlashes? And of course, again, I think we need to really look very carefully at the evidence and not be swayed by entrenched political rhetoric that seems to be intent on maintaining kind of a facade and an entrenched position, which is, I think, what we heard from Councilmember Mike Rotkin last week. I've invited Rotkin back, by the way, as I said before, to really get into the details of why and what evidence he has to support his magnet theory, of which he could present no evidence at City Council when challenged by Councilmember Keith Sugar. And it's, you know, as I said, it was pretty well discredited, the magnet theory, at least in the eyes of the council majority, Sugar, Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Byers. I think that was pretty much the case. I actually can't speak for Fitzmaurice, but certainly the task force, or task force as I call it, one of the few good things they did was they discredited the magnet theory, not because they went out of their way to do it, but because we flooded them with information and essentially forced them to pay some attention to it. The so-called task force on homelessness, which was supposed to be formed on this coming Tuesday, has been postponed yet again. Not that I think it makes much difference, since more talk about this issue is just that. Still, it's an indication of something. We've got an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
I have a question. I just opened up my newspaper a little bit late. On Thursday, April 8th, Rotkin and Silva, I guess, talked it out on your radio station.
That's true.
Are you guys going to play that again?
Well, we hadn't planned to, but we might be playing some of the highlights. We've also, as I said, invited Rotkin back to have a kind of a return bout.
So how was it?
It wasn't as long as I'd hoped. We didn't really explore matters in as much depth as I'd hoped, but, you know, I think both sides sort of came out slugging. It's hard to get the mic away from Mike Rotkin. They don't call him Mike Rotkin for nothing.
Right.
We certainly had the phones ringing off the hook, so that's true. We didn't get much response to our poll when we asked people to vote as to who won. I think we only got one call afterward, and
yeah.
So...
Well, hopefully they can go more at an angle of actually dealing with the issue instead of making it a slugfest.
It's real hard to get Mike Rotkin to deal with the issue. In order to do that, we're going to probably set up a forum whereby we limit the questions and the focus of the issue so that...
People have an opportunity to actually speak without feeling defensive.
It is true that Mike is under a lot of pressure when he's here in the studio because he has really been the key figure in keeping the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz for the last decade.
Wasn't he elected as a homeless advocate or something like that?
Well, he regards himself as a pro-homeless kind of person who pushes for shelters and pushes for reform in the police department, or did 20 years ago when there was a lot of beatings of homeless people by police.
What was his take?
His take on...
No.
Oh, his take now is that Santa Cruz needs to keep the sleeping ban because even though we need more shelter, police are very discreet in what they do to homeless people in terms of sleeping, that if you know how to camp lightly on the land, you're not going to get in any trouble, or if you do, that's just, you know, one of the problems. It's sort of like a problem all over the country, and it's a problem here, but if we give up the sleeping ban, then we would have a complete crackdown on homeless people because people would get outraged at homeless people would come from all over the nation to sleep on our streets. And I think it's a series of spurious arguments he made, but that was his take on it. He you know, he says, oh, if somebody will only bring me a proposal for increased shelter, I would love it. But he's been saying that.
Break. You know, as part of city council, he has the opportunity to help create something.
Yeah, he has, and he's done nothing in the last 3 years other than fund this Cadillac Rolls-Royce community house project for 40 people, which, you know, I mean, let's admit it, it does provide 40 beds, but it's, you know, it supplanted a homeless campground. And it isn't really low-income housing. It's another one of these expensive transitional programs that funds middle-class jobs and essentially creams. You know, it takes people who are likely to be successful anyway and then makes a good show and says and pats itself on the back.
Right.
You know, so I'm not trying to totally discredit it or dismiss it.
Where is it located at?
It's located on the side of the old Back 40 out at Coral Street at River and Highway 1 near the Homeless Services Center.
Yeah, well, Santa Cruz definitely has to do something about just even temporary beds that are in decent condition and people don't really feel as threatened as... Because I heard, like, the homeless shelter itself, where people do go at... For women with children, it's not a really favorable place to stay. And it seems that a lot of people actually choose to really take the chances on the streets than go into the shelter, and there's a problem with that. There has to be more accommodations that are set up.
Yeah, well, the Armory is, of course, probably what you're referring to. The Armory is, you know... It's closed now. It'll be closed until next year in November.
So what are they doing for the amount of beds that are lost right there?
Nothing.
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, you know, that's just...
They have a thing called the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Church Program, which lets you sleep on the floor of a church, 30 spaces on the floor of a church for 500 to 1,500 people who sleep outside. So it's, you might say, pretty preposterous. You know,
that is ridiculous. I've seen people, a lot of youth, which really surprised me, but... You know, people taking advantage of the new building that's been built, there's lights into the sidewalk, like a glass plate over the light. So I've seen people sleeping on that for warmth. But it's just, it's way too cold and wet, you know. And
no
for
question.
People to not have a place to go to at night, and to see people walking around at 1 or 2 in the morning, because I have a job that's from, like, midnight until 7 in the morning, and just, like, there's nothing to do. There's no place to go, and they can't sleep because they'll get a ticket, and so they're left wandering the streets, going from coffee shop to coffee shop or whatever is open to try and stay warm. And it's not a really great way of living. There's no way to pull yourself out of it if you're totally stressed every single day of your life because you don't even have a place to stay.
Are you homeless yourself, caller?
No, I'm not, but...
You've seen this happening?
But, I mean, I've gone places. I've gone, like, to Hawaii and various places where I didn't have anything to begin with. So
why don't we open up the mic here? We actually have an in-studio guest who's been patiently waiting for the last hour or longer to join us. So... If you have more you want to say, you're welcome to stay on the line, but we're gonna open the mic up to Edward DeBolt.
Okay.
And he can join the conversation. Hey, Edward, give us a reading level. Say speak into the mic.
Hello.
A little louder, a little closer.
Hello.
Okay. So, Edward, have you been listening to the caller? Been hearing her speak?
Yes, I have.
And what's your feeling? I'm always bringing the issue back to the sleeping van. But the caller has been talking about how homeless people at night have no shelter. They walk around all night. You yourself have housing, right?
Yes, I do.
Yes.
And you're concerned about how police treat both homeless and non-homeless people?
That's true.
I can barely hear. Are you asking him?
Yeah. You get closer and speak louder. I'm sorry. We got a kind of a poor mic here. Talk a little louder.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear him now?
Yeah.
Okay, that's good.
Okay.
Stay at that level. So... Well, maybe we should do this. Are you at a phone you can conveniently call back, or do you have to spend 35 cents?
I can call back.
Why don't you listen in? Call back if you'd like.
Okay.
Because what we want to do is introduce Edward and have him talk a bit about his own experiences
here,
and then you can, you know...
Okay. Thank you.
Sure, make this a part of, you know, ongoing discussion.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So, Edward DeBolt, you gave me a call about a week ago, and why did you give me a call?
Because I was really mad at the police. They've been harassing me for the last couple months now. And I spoke to you once before on a different occasion, and I was talking and a older gentleman came up and asked me, would I like to talk to you? And I said yes, and we walked over to the payphone immediately, and we called you, and I left a message. And then we played phone tag for 2 or 3 days, and then I finally got a hold of you.
Now, we've actually done some talking, but I'm going to act as though we hadn't, since the audience hasn't heard what's been going on with you. But you've had some conflicts with the law. yourself, mostly stemming from a really difficult early situation with your childhood. You had a traumatic incident that happened then. I don't know if you want to talk about that on the air. You're welcome to if you'd like to. But more recently, you got on probation for what crime or what supposed crime?
Assault and battery, which is 242 Penal Code. Terrorist threats, which is a 422 Penal Code, which is a felony. The 242 assault and battery is a misdemeanor. And disturbing the peace, which is, I don't know the penal code
for
that.
Well, that sounds pretty bad. What does that actually reduce to in terms of real behavior? What did you do that they found so bad?
I told a guy, for the 422 PC terrorist threats, I told a guy, don't ever open up my mail again, or I wouldn't want to be you.
That's what you said?
And that's what I said. He calls the sheriffs on me, they come, they pull out their guns. They evacuated the whole building I was in. There was about 85 people. I mean, they shuffled out the doors like I was the Unabomber and I was about to blow up the whole building. They set off the alarm. The security came. They tried to talk to me. They called the sheriffs. The sheriffs came. They took my statement. They took the guy's statement. And then they arrested me, threw me in jail. I was in jail approximately 3 days. And I got out. And got it reduced to a misdemeanor, disturbing the peace.
Now, you told me that once before that I guess a deputy had run across you with a bag of marijuana, and you responded by punching him out at one point.
Yeah, yes, I did.
And any comments about that? Your average middle class person would say that's violent behavior, and also, and I'm not trying to judge you here, but I'm trying to give a sense of what. Try to consider what our audience would be thinking, or some of our audience, but also it seems unwise behavior because you're attacking someone with a weapon. What were you, are you a guy who usually punches people out in arguments? What's the story?
No, I'm not that type of guy, but that day, I was under the influence of a lot of narcotics, marijuana, and I just really didn't care, I didn't care where I was going to go, what was going to happen. I just went for what I call the gold.
So marijuana in this case, whereas most people it reportedly makes them less aggressive or violent, you would have the opposite effect, or?
No, I just felt, kind of dazed and confused, and I really didn't care what would happen,
Now, you've been, how old are you?
I'm 21.
And you've been on your own for how long?
Since I was 17 and a half.
And you've been an emancipated minor for how long? Or when you were a minor?
6 months.
You were an emancipated minor since what age?
17 and 6 months old.
Okay. And you actually...
was homeless for a year and 10 months.
And you're... To describe your racial look, so to speak, on the streets, you're darker skinned than I am, I'm not as white as I could be, but I'm pretty white. You're Mediterranean, you're a Persian background, what else?
Italian and Sicilian.
And Italian and Sicilian, so watch out. I got to watch out for this guy. So, I guess I'm thinking so much, you told me so much in this interview that we had earlier, and I'm just kind of trying to decide where to begin. Would you like to talk about the precipitating incident in your life way back in the teen days that kind of put you in a, well, it had some serious consequences for you, both in terms of your living situation, also, I assume, psychologically?
True.
And what was that incident?
I was 10 years old, and my dad, one day we loaded up some 12 gauges, a couple shotguns. He had a .45, a .357 underneath the car seat, and we went to shoot guns at a place called New Melanies. It's a lake which is right next to Tuolumne County, which is up in the Motherlode country. And we went up to the rocks and we're just shooting, rocks and whatever, And then we went to a bar in this place called Columbia National Park.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to the bar and my father and my mother drank, and I'm only 10 years old, and I ate some nachos and stuff. And we left there, and we were walking down the street, and my dad asked my sister to buy him a paper. He hands her 50 cents, but this was a Sunday, so insane, the paper was more than 50 cents. I think it was like 75 cents, because back then papers used to be a lot cheaper. And she went over, and she came back, and she said she needs another quarter, and my dad told her that he wasn't going to give her another quarter. And my mom reaches into her purse and tries to grab a quarter, and my dad gets mad, tells me and my sister come with him. We walk away. We get in the car. We turn on the Highway 80, which is over by Sacramento, and we're going down the highway. My mom steps out in the middle of the road. My dad stops the car.
Why did your mom step out?
Because we were leaving her.
I see.
And she got in the car. He stopped the car. She got in. And for the next half hour, he beat her. He kept on. And he beat her so bad that her eyeball came out of her eye, was hanging by, I don't know, whatever, veins. And then we got down to Jamestown, California, which is where we lived. And he stopped the car, and he walked over to the payphone and called 911 and told him to come get my mom. And he walks away, and when he's walking down, there's a truck driver. And he points the gun at the truck driver. And the truck driver kind of goes down onto his seat, you know. And my dad shoots the mirror off the truck. Walks about a quarter of a mile down. It's like a big old dirt lot that you have a flea market on it every weekend. And the flea market had just ended, so no one was there, luckily. And he walks all the way down, and I get out of the car. I call 911. My sister calls 911. And I walk. I'm kind of, you know, playing Mr. Detective, you know, seeing what's going to happen. And I'm walking down either side of the lot, you know, trying to dodge behind trucks and cars and so he wouldn't see me. And when I finally found him, I went a little bit more east and then came around a house into a creek.
But cutting to the chase, what happened that was really the crucial incident here?
Oh, he had his gun in his mouth, and he looked at me and I looked at him, and he pointed the gun at me and he clicked it back, and then the police must have just came up and they pulled out their shotgun from the standard shotgun in the front of the seat and blew his leg off right in front of me. And a police officer then jumped on me before, you know, and almost drowned me.
Because you were in the water?
Yeah.
So your father, did he survive that loss of his leg? Or?
Yes, he did. Now his leg is six inches shorter than the other one.
Uh-huh. So that was rather traumatic for you, and you know, you had a history of this kind of stuff. I guess I'm not sure where I'm going with this really, except to give a kind of a specific background of you personally. You had this encounter with the deputies where you punched out a deputy who found you with some marijuana, and then you most recently had another encounter with the police, and that encounter with the police concerned you. You want to talk a little bit about that, or I guess you want me to summarize it?
I could tell you a little bit about it. On a Tuesday of last week, I was coming back from the 120 showing of The Matrix from Cinema 9 in downtown Santa Cruz on Pacific Avenue, and I was walking down the street, and I go across the street to where New Leaf Organic Market is, and I'm walking past where the downtown host, and they have a little police center in there. And there's these two police officers, and they keep on looking at me, and I look at them. I'm smoking a cigar. And so I keep on walking down the road, and I get to where Pacific Grove Music is. And these two kids I know are there, and I start talking to them. And then all of a sudden, the two police officers that were down at the downtown host area were in their car, and they were both staring at me, and they're going really, really slow. And so I crouch down to about a 3-foot level, and I look right back at them. Before the driver, the police car stopped, the passenger cop was already out the door. He was out the door. I mean, he opened up the door, jumped out. The car was still moving. He runs over to me and asked me, do I have a problem? I told him no. And he said, are you mad dogging me? I told him, no, I'm looking at your nice shiny car. I always wanted one. And then he goes in to a thing, you know, where he asked me for my ID, and I give him my ID, and I told him, you have nothing on me. I don't have any warrants. And so he goes through my ID, calls and does the NCIC, which is a national warrant check. He does that. He gets an okay to search me on the street, because I have a search clause, which means I can be searched any time of the day. And so he takes off my coat, he searches me, he looks at me, he tells me, I will bust you 10 times a day in front of all your friends and get you embarrassed and arrest you if I have reason to. And then he pulls out a Polaroid camera, takes 3 pictures of me, and tells me to have a nice day, and he walks away. No, I didn't. Yes, I do.
Sorry, my mic was off. You can, Let's see what this phone call has to say.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, that's what I was calling to tell you, Robert, was
the mic
pretty
is
much
off.
Gone out, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, all right. I'll let you get back to your interview.
Any comments?
No, I just want to thank your guest for having the courage to come to your show and share his story with people. I think it's really powerful. Yeah, thanks for having another good show.
Thanks for monitoring my board.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm going to repeat that, and I apologize for the dead air, folks. If you want to file a complaint with the CPRB, Citizens Police Review Board, which does have new membership under the new city council, and that they may be more active. In the past, they've been not just utterly useless, but I would say counterproductive, because they've given the police a patent of respectability. They are reachable at the 915 Cedar Street office downtown, Monday through Thursday from 9 to 1. And you can also get forms at other times, like at the library, at the clerk's office, which is at City Hall, at the police station, if you're willing to go there. Presumably the hosts at the downtown hosts headquarters next to the Del Mar Theater should have them, but they have not had them, which tends to me to show how seriously or how lightly the city is really taking the rights of citizens who have been abused by the police. And there's also a meeting of the Citizens Police Review Board the second Monday of every month, which, as fate would have it, happens to be tomorrow at 5:30, and that's at City Council Chambers at 809 Center Street. For those of you who know the City Council meetings, it's the same building, it's the same place. And for the first half hour from 5:30 to 6, there's an oral communications period. And if Lisa Rose doesn't decide to censor us all, as she has in the past, it used to have unlimited oral communications. Now there is only 3 minutes for each person. We're hoping to get that time resumed, because we feel that people should be able to tell their stories the way Edward is telling his story here on the air. And, of course, if you have any comments, if you've been hassled by police or had some problems, or just seen something you don't like, or perhaps seen something you do like, feel the police are doing a good job and that they need to be commended, and that this is an exceptional case, or possibly you don't think it's a case worth discussing, or you disagree with Edwards' interpretation of events, give us a call here at 427-3772, 427-FRSC, at Free Radio Santa Cruz. That's what you're listening to, 96.3 FM. So, Edward, you've been homeless. What's the situation like for a homeless person in Santa Cruz? Want to give us any comments on that?
Being homeless here in Santa Cruz is pretty much, you know, you can't sleep. You can be homeless, you're just not allowed to sleep in this town.
Well, can't you sleep during the day?
You can sleep during the day, but how can you sleep during the day? I mean, if it was dark, you know, you could sleep, but it's not dark during the day. I mean, it's hot, it's sunny, it keeps you up. You can't sleep anywhere. To sleep in this town, you have to go outside the city limits where there's, you know, no one at. You know, you can't sleep on a bench. You can't sleep at the park. I mean,
when you were sleeping during the day at a park? Are you talking about at night at a park?
I mean, during the day. I mean, in this town, it's illegal. The ordinance is you can be homeless. You just can't sleep during the night between 11 p.m. and 8:30 a.m.
Wow.
You cannot sleep.
I'm impressed. You know the specifics of the law. Go ahead.
And you cannot cover yourself up with blankets. And what are you supposed to do? I mean, I've been talking to some people over this matter. It's cold. It's hitting 30 degrees. It's raining. What are you supposed to do? They have the homeless shelter, the Page system. It's called the Betty Page Transitional Center, which is behind the homeless shelter River Street.
Oh, you're talking about Page Smith.
Page
Community
Smith,
House.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yes.
Go ahead.
And that's not enough. I mean, there's so many people homeless, and every day someone else comes in from out of town. I mean, we got people from Washington from New York City to Baltimore to Oklahoma to Louisiana to Alabama to Tennessee. Utah, Nevada, Arizona. I mean, these are people I know from where they come from. They're just coming in recently in the last couple months.
Do you think people are being drawn to town by the... There was a time in the last few months when we thought there would be some change in the city's sleeping ban. Do you think that if the law were made more liberal so that you could sleep at night without being arrested, would this bring a lot of people to town?
It probably would.
So you think it would bring people. Do you agree with Mike Rotkin then? Because that's one of the arguments used by Councilmember Rotkin for not changing the law. He thinks it would bring a lot of people to town, but you candidly think it would. I mean, so again, it was...
Well, I think that if they did make sleeping illegal...
Mm-hmm. Sleeping legal?
Making sleeping legal at
right.
between 11 p.m. and 8 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
I doubt that it would bring any more people, but... I'm contradicting myself right now, but
yeah, don't let me change your mind. I mean, you might honestly.
I'm not changing
that.
My
yeah.
mind. I'm just yeah. I'm thinking again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, if they made it legal here in this town, there probably wouldn't be any more like a status raise of the people, because I mean, it is like people like call up other people that are homeless and you know tell them, oh, we can sleep now. You know, oh, everyone, come on, let's go. You know, it's not like that.
You know, it's kind of an interesting superficial argument I think he uses, and in a way it has plausibility, because you think, well, if it's easier to sleep in a certain place, then maybe more people will come. But in fact, all the evidence of people who've lifted their sleeping bans shows us essentially that that's not true, and also national surveys on that subject show people who are homeless don't really move from one place to another because of those concerns. They move because of jobs. I mean, if you put out a flyer that says there's all kinds of jobs people may come, they move because they're driven out of certain towns and areas like in San Francisco or from Berkeley. But they're generally, the evidence of the National Law Center for Homelessness and Poverty, which has done a lot of studies on this, is that they don't move if you, for example, liberalize the laws such as restoring civil rights in a certain area. People just don't rush there. Because, you know, their major concerns are family and so forth and other factors in the town they're in. The support system they have, what they're doing in that town. And a lot of... Let me ask you this. Here in Santa Cruz, Do you see a lot of the same homeless faces? Do you see a lot of new faces? What's your sense about that?
In the last 2 years, I've seen pretty much the same population. And what I see, kids that are 17 or so, they'll be new faces, and they'll start coming out from their homes. I mean, they literally have homes, mothers, fathers that take care of them, and they'll get mixed in with the homeless community, and then pretty soon there'll be new faces. They'll become homeless, and then they'll be walking around and doing things and being homeless. I mean, it's like people are drawn to being homeless. I know. It's like in the last 2 years, I've met maybe 2,600 homeless people. I mean, right now, I know like almost every homeless person in this town. I mean, the young, the old, the middle-aged.
Do you think that there's some conservative merchants and residents who believed, well, I know this was true a decade ago, we heard this, that they thought that somehow, people thought that Santa Cruz was an easy touch, so a lot of homeless people came here, but more important, that there was a homeless by choice lifestyle, that people just sort of thought it was a kick and a wonderful thing to do, to be homeless. Are people doing it for the fun of it, for the thrill of it? Are they doing it because they're getting evicted at two or three times the rate they were a year ago, as is happening in San Francisco, for instance? Are they doing it because of economic problems? We've heard the economy is getting better, not worse, for most people. Or at least, let's say, in terms of the... if you have stock in the stock market, things are certainly going up. If you've got weapons business, things are booming with the bombs in Serbia. Are people here homeless by choice mostly or by necessity? What's your sense on that?
Probably by necessity. There's a low choice of jobs. I mean, they're all taken. And most people that live in this town, they commute to Silicon Valley, which is in San Jose, Santa Clara County. And there's a low thing of jobs. And then housing... a studio apartment will run you about $575, $600. And if you don't have the studio apartment, you can still rent a little one bedroom in someone's house for $575 to $675. And then to get on HUD, which is a housing urban development, that's an 8-year waiting list.
Section 8, you mean?
Section 8.
Uh-huh. Section 8
and
housing.
And that takes 8 years, and I mean, who's going to, you know, be homeless for 8 years? I mean, they probably could do it for a couple of years, but they're not going to stay here forever, you know?
Well, I know that there are a lot of people on that list, and there's still a lot of people on that list. I guess they struggle and they strive. You don't really have a choice if you're homeless. You look around. We're talking to Edward DeBolt, who's been homeless, who recently contacted HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and SPAN, Stop Police Abuse Now, two groups that are concerned with, rights of poor people particularly. And he's giving his thoughts. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3 FM. And our lines are open if you want to reach us at 427-3772. If you have any thoughts on this, call in.
Telling me what's going on. Screw the FCC. Set your radio free. My radio is trying to get along, but it just could not take the same old song. It said we could have our own top 10 of songs we like to do. Screw the FCC. Set your radio free. Yes, set your radio free. Set your radio free, yeah. Screw the FCC, yeah. Get your radio, set your radio free. Well, my mama said don't play around with electricity, but now my voice is heard across the hills of Tennessee. My radio is driving me insane. Ed said goodbye to Philip K. And we all hope his retirement is as pleasant as can be. Screw the FCC. Set your radio free. Set your radio free. Yeah, screw the FCC. Yeah, get your radio. Set your radio free. Set your radio free. Yeah, screw the FCC. Yeah, get your radio. Set your radio. Hail and well, met your radio. Set your radio free.
And that was Carol Denny, Set Your Radio Free, from her fine album, Failure to Disperse. I occasionally pick up the New York Times, because they've been covering a lot of the official U.S. propaganda on the bombing of Serbia, which I think is a crock of shit, frankly, and I encourage you to call in and talk about that issue if you want, though, again, I try to focus on civil rights for the poor, but I guess probably in most wartime situations, it's the poor are getting shafted because they're the people who have the least shelter and the most vulnerable, whether it's to the drug war or the bombing war. It's poor people that get the shaft. Those who have enough money can find ways to deal with the shortages that happen in war. Those who don't get shafted. But New York Times also has been covering the jail situation, the prison situation. And there's a very interesting story by Fox Butterfield in the Wednesday New York Times, April 7th, talking about children in prisons. Really an interesting story. I recommend you check it out. I'm going to kind of run through a few stats that they point out in this story. That there are now 7 million children with a parent in jail or prison or recently released on probation or parole. 7 million. And these numbers alarm experts who say that having a parent behind bars is the factor that puts a child at greatest risk for becoming a juvenile delinquent and adult criminal. There are 1.96 million children who have a parent or other close relative in jail or prison on any given day. That's nearly 2 million kids have a parent in jail. And we're talking, of course, about jail for stuff like marijuana, the drug war, victimless crimes of that sort, as well as more violent crimes. The link between the generations is so strong that half of all juveniles in custody have a father, mother, or other close relative who has been in jail or prison. Pretty amazing statistic, according to Alan J. Beck, chief of the corrections statistics at the Bureau. I guess that's the Bureau of Justice Statistics, a branch of the Justice Department. And 5 million more children have parents who have been incarcerated or on probation or parole. So 2 million actually have folks in jail. Incarceration also, according to this article, adds a special hazard. Children who see a parent arrested and handcuffed and who are frisked by guards during a prison visit become contemptuous toward law enforcement. I would say they become angry at the dehumanization that happens. They also point out that children with a father behind bars may make a hero of him, and inmates themselves are often evasive about their children out of shame or fear of losing custody or government benefits. There is little research on the subject, so that there is no agreement even on the seemingly simple issue of whether it is good for children to visit their fathers or mothers behind bars, says Juliana Perez, social worker, directs a parenting program in San Antonio at the county jail. If the system doesn't allow bonding, we destroy whatever chance we have of changing the offender's behavior. On the other hand, Judge Kathleen Ritchie of the juvenile court in Baton Rouge, L.A., Louisiana, says the more these kids are exposed to prison by visiting, the more they get used to it, and prison loses its stigma. So there are arguments for keeping kids away from jails and their parents in jail. It's actually keeping kids away from their parents we're talking about, and arguments for doing the opposite. Here's a mother who was puzzled why prison visits were a problem. She had taken her children to visit her friends and relatives in prison for years before her own arrest. 3 of the 4 children have since been arrested and sent to juvenile prison. Nationwide, fewer than a quarter of male inmates are married, and fewer than a third are visited by their families, but 2/3 of them have children. Prison destroys families, said Hector Milan, a 38-year-old from East Harlem serving a 20-year-to-life sentence for murder. I can't tuck my children in bed at night. I can't be there to comfort them when they scrape their knees. I can't help them when they have problems at school. The damage done is irreparable. And he's enrolled in a program which tries to impart lessons that prisoners should stay in touch with their children, they should not make false promises about when they will be released, and that they should acknowledge the pain they have caused their children, who are also victims of their crimes, possibly also victims of the system that criminalizes some people as well. There's a growing body of research that shows maintaining family ties while in prison leads to lower rates of rearrest for the fathers and makes a difference in the lives of the kids. On the other hand, visits by wives and children are often viewed as a security threat by prison officials, or at least a nuisance, because they can be an opportunity to smuggle drugs or weapons, and they consume guards' time. Can you imagine? In the 1940s, two pioneering researchers at Harvard Law School, Sheldon and Eleanor Gluck, found that among boys sent to a reformatory from the Boston area, two-thirds had a father who had been incarcerated and half had a grandfather who had been locked up. Race was not an issue. All these boys were white. But the question was, what about class? The most recent research conducted last year in California among 1,000 girls in detention in Los Angeles, San Diego, Alameda, and Marin counties revealed that 54% of their mothers and 46% of their fathers had been locked up. Corrections officials are sometimes stunned to find whole families locked up. At the Laurel Highlands State Prison in Pennsylvania, a father and a son convicted of separate arsons share the same cell. At the Allegheny County Jail in Pittsburgh, a father, mother, and their four sons and two daughters were all incarcerated for different bank robberies. In California, a daughter, her mother, and her grandmother were in one prison, women's prison, for separate crimes. And the article really goes into a lot of detail, which I encourage you to look at. Again, this is the New York Times for April 7th, Wednesday, April 7th. On the front page, as inmate population grows, so does a focus on children. So usually we talk mostly about civil rights for poor people, and I guess certainly prisons are where you really lose your civil rights. So I guess if they shoot you, you can also lose them in a more absolute sense. But there are a few, mostly we've got gloomy news, you know, on the air. But here's a little bit of good news. At least for me it's good news as a civil libertarian. Here's an article from the San Francisco Examiner. San Pablo cops take drunks off booze blacklist. This is from April 8th, San Francisco Examiner. Eight men singled out by police as public drunks will be allowed back in liquor stores. Last fall, police visited the city's 27 liquor stores with mugshots of the men and warned the owners that they could be cited if they sold booze to anyone on the list. But the city is taking back the police blacklist, letting the men return to the stores, and paying $5,000 to the Gray Panthers, a seniors group that helps the men with food, rides, and clothes. An 1889 state law prohibiting alcohol sales to habitual drunks was overturned by the state Supreme Court in 1960, City Attorney Brian Libo said. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, which represented three of the men, sent an intent to sue notice to the San Pablo police. This just goes to show poor people can fight City Hall and win, said Attorney Oren Selstrom, who said the group since has agreed not to file a lawsuit. They stood up for their right to not be unfairly labeled by the government. Well, I would say it shows how arrogant a police department can be, trying to restrict the basic rights of adult people in a fashion that they know is not only unconstitutional, but apparently illegal. That is to say that the law under which it was done was overturned 40 years ago, yet they suddenly decide they're going to do it anyway. And the police department decides it wants to act. That's what it does. And that's another thing we actually found out when we talked to Mike Rotkin last week. He was telling us, trust the police department. He was telling us, police department arrests only or gives people sleeping tickets or hassles them for sleeping only if after they've warned them and only on complaint. Or if the person is in such a high-profile area that they, quote, want to be arrested. And so I challenged Councilmember Rotkin. I said, gee, Mike, if that's true, then why don't we simply put into the law that people only should be arrested if there is a specific bona fide complaint and after being given a warning, as is the case, well, not the complaint provision, but the warning provision is the case with the downtown ordinances, like for sitting. You can't be arrested just if a cop sees you sitting. He has to say, move on, and that's it's illegal to do that, and then you can be arrested. So why not the same with the sleeping ban? Well, he says he doesn't want to do that. And he said it's because you don't trust the police department. And then I think then he went into a discussion of what a bad influence I was on the Santa Cruz community, not entirely relevant to the issue at hand. In fact, I think, frankly, that he is the bad influence because he's the man with the power of the city council at his hand. He's the man who has made it criminal for homeless people to sleep at night and continues to promulgate all this massive misinformation. But again, trusting the police department to do the right thing is something you do in a police state. And if you feel a police state is a good idea, well, then I guess Mike Rotkin is your man, at least on this particular issue.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, thanks. This is Brian.
Hi, Brian.
Hi, your most recent commentary makes me wonder if it's time to begin a Santa Cruz chapter of the Biotic Baking Brigade.
Of course, the Biotic Baking Brigade is what?
Oh, you'd like me to explain it?
Please.
Seems that it was founded in France. I'm not quite sure. At least it's reached its most popular incarnation there. But more recently, members of the Biotic Baking Brigade in San Francisco are doing 6 months in jail for pieing Mayor Willie Brown regarding his empty rhetoric regarding homeless issues.
Right. I know that Jerry Brown recently, I saw in an article a couple of days ago, became concerned and upped his security to stop the biotic bakers from, crossing his line, so to speak, after all the... And I did promise, it was sort of half in jest, that the loser of the debate would be given a special pie. And we actually were unable at airtime last Thursday when Mike Rotkin debated David Silva on the sleeping ban over the air to get the appropriate pies in order. And I think that... I think you're right. I think a little pie in the eye, so to speak, would sharpen our vision, maybe even sharpen the vision of those who receive that kind of nutritional support, if you will. I think, unfortunately, the consequences in San Francisco for Rahula Janowski and the other two biotic baker people who pied Willie Brown was 6 months in jail, and they are now currently serving that. I guess they can be out in 4 months, but it may be a death sentence for one of the folks who's got a cancer condition and who isn't eating. He's a vegan, and he's refusing to eat the prison bologna sandwich situation that they're giving him. I haven't heard the latest update. Maybe you know something about that. I don't. Have you heard any more about that?
I haven't.
Well, I know that the question has been coming up, what can we do here in Santa Cruz now that the city council has shown it is a washout on the issue of ending the sleeping ban? And I guess you're a UC student?
That's right.
And I guess you work with a group of students against the sleeping ban.
I have.
And I don't really know quite which way to go, although it seems...
Well, one thing that I would like to offer, perhaps kind of in the spirit of the debate that Mike and David had, to hold a debate either on your show or perhaps in the Rascals Forum, which is another student group that has extensive use of Kresge Town Hall, is I would be more than willing to debate any member of the Downtown Association, the Harvey West Group, the Downtown Neighbors, any number of these people who spoke at City Council. I'm particularly interested in debating the gentleman who was so proud that he had wore a tie to show his respect for the council. I'm afraid I don't know his name, but that's how I will remember him. I believe he's with Downtown Neighbors. But I won't speak for anyone else, but I would imagine there's other activists or community members who would be interested in such a debate. We can tape it. We can send it to City Council. We can show it to people who are interested.
Well, I think that's a great idea. I know that the Rascals last year did have a debate between me and Mike Rotkin on campus.
Right.
I thought that... It was a good debate, although some people felt I was too harsh with Councilmember Rotkin. I think I was too lenient, particularly too lenient on this Thursday. Of course, I was the moderator. I wasn't really doing the debating. I mean, the reason I actually sponsored this debate with Rotkin or invited him on the air was because he and I had a conversation after the last city council meeting that I went to, I guess the March 23rd sleeping ban sellout meeting, where we discovered, or some of us discovered after 3 months, that Byers and her gang of merry liberals were in no way serious about ending the sleeping ban or restoring civil rights to homeless people. But Rotkin and I got together and talked afterward, he told me that he had gotten different information about the magnet effect, the so-called magnet effect, and my information coming from different towns in Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Miami, and Hollywood, Florida, was that it was actually the exact opposite of the magnet effect, at least part of it. There was, one, no additional rise in people coming to the area when there was a tent city there and when there was a safe sleeping zones there for 5 years, between 1992 and 7 years in 1999, but also that the visible presence of homeless people in public places did not have the effect of making people less compassionate and less willing to pay into tax funds for building new resources, but more so that they got an influx of money that was significantly greater than anything they had before. And it just seemed to me that Mike's argument was just upside down, and that I would like to see, he claimed that he had contacted some council member there, and they had said there was an influx of people and that they had problems and so forth. He has a sort of a series of vague accusations he usually comes out with when we try to present what I think is the definitive evidence against his NIMBY theories, not in my backyard theories, against restoring homeless rights for civil rights for homeless people. And of course the problem is that in order to debate this with Mike, you really have to choose your format carefully, because he tends to go into other topics. And
well, for instance, one of the most frustrating things that I experienced at the very end of the debate was you were trying to pin him down on, do you believe that the sleeping ban violates human rights? And rather than give a yes or no answer, his response was, well, no more than not providing dental care for all the members of the community.
Which is really pretty preposterous.
It's totally preposterous, and it's similar to what I've raised with Mayor Byers when, asked, do you think the sleeping ban criminalizes homeless people? Well, no more than giving, a parking ticket criminalizes the person who owns the car. And it's this complete inability to basically stand up for what is obviously, their position by their actions through their words. And, one person in the council chambers afterwards said, well, it's total politics 101, and I don't know why I was naive enough to think that our local politicians would be any different than our national politicians, but so
no,
be it.
It is. It's a lesson for us. And I think that not only are these people, not standing up for what their positions are, but they're giving you completely spurious arguments.
Right.
Catherine Byers claimed that getting a ticket has no more significance to a homeless person than to a person in a house getting an automobile ticket is utterly ridiculous.
Right.
Because homeless people face failures to appear that will put them in jail. And lest some people think that this is some sort of housing for homeless people, it is not. You get arrested and then you get released at 2 in the morning on the streets, and it's freezing cold, or you get arrested and you held in a cold area for hour after hour. It is not any kind of housing. It is preposterous. And Rotkin's claim that it's somehow equivalent to not getting dental care. And the point was made to, I guess, by my producer afterward. Well, if they were telling you that if you got dental care, you would be arrested, then it might be equivalent, because they're telling you if you fall asleep at night outside, then you're going to get arrested, and that somehow that's okay. He just doesn't. These people, of course, obviously don't want to confront it, because part of their whole Weltanschauung and their mystique and the constituency's ideology that brings them to power year after year is that they're such great liberals and human rights supporters, or more than that, that they're progressives who want to advance the human rights struggle.
Right.
Anyway, that's, I think, what that's about. But I'd love to have you or someone arrange a debate. I know that the Rascals were interested in this issue last year, and they're a group up on campus. What are they called? What's the Rascal an acronym for?
Radical Action Student Coalition Against Lies and Suppression.
There we go.
Yeah.
That sounds good. I know that they were interested last year, but I haven't seen them doing too much this year, and I think, as we know, I guess the window for student activism is limited, because people immediately go into finals as you hit May.
Well, right, and it's not so much a window as it is just an infinite amount of, issues you could look at. This quarter, we're helping out other groups rather than maybe putting forth any one thing by ourselves. We're doing some stuff with the Women's California Coalition for Women Prisoners and Prison Awareness.
I know that 7 p.m. tomorrow, there's a thing at Oak's Mural Room, UC Santa Cruz, the prison industrial complex, breaking it down.
Right.
Ruthie Gilmore, activist and scholar from UC Berkeley Geography and Women's Studies, Rose Braze, criminal defense attorney of the Critical Resistance Organizing Committee, Dorsey Nunn, Program Director, Legal Services for Prisoners with Children, and Scott Fleming, National Lawyers Guild, along with the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality, Stolen Lives Display on tour, at California Coalition for Women Prisoners, Mumia Coalition, and so forth. Again, Monday, April 12th, tomorrow, 7 p.m., that, throwing in a plug here, who are 1.8 million Americans incarcerated, who are they, and who is profiting? That's all happening.
Right, and then there's also somewhat of a sense that we need to mobilize to really inform people about the parking structure that is going to go up, and there's definitely city council hearings on that. And then, of course, on an international scale, we have war in Yugoslavia and war in Africa and, you know, lots of other things that we're trying to educate people on. And then, but the homeless sleeping ban issue is a constant part of, you know, what we work for. One of our members is, you know, finalizing a movie on police brutality, and we plan to hopefully show that this quarter.
I mean, I think that...
And like I said, we would certainly be able to get Kresge Town Hall this quarter for any sort of, whether it was a debate or a forum or a roundtable or any of a number of forums.
I think it would be nice to get Mayor Byers to explain just how it was she couldn't find a place for homeless people anywhere in Santa Cruz. I mean, it's a pretty big town with a significant amount of green belt area, and you would think that somewhere in that area that you know, certainly if there were an earthquake, they would find a place for any displaced middle class people, but they just can't seem to do it for poor people. And it's
well, not only not do it, but they've completely turned it around and said that it's our responsibility to find a place and then come to them and answer their tough questions about, you know, what are the ramifications. And to digress, I think as skateboard riders in this county will tell you, you know, you can get promised something, but until, you know, there's supposedly a place to put it where it doesn't step on a single toe, it's not going to happen. So Santa Cruz has no skate park, you know, and it has no place for homeless people to sleep. Those are two very different issues. I'm not trying to mix human rights with human expression, per se. But perhaps you get my point that, you know, even if we were to say, well, how about here? They could probably shoot it down. How about here? They could shoot it down.
Oh, they did. They have. Throughout 1995 and 96, when there was actually a campground in place until December, Scott Kennedy and Catherine Byers and Celia Scott were all supposed to be the big liberals running around looking for a campground. And I was on this campground subcommittee, and they found something wrong with every single place. And they eventually allowed the Citizens Committee for the Homeless. They facilitated their locking the gate of their field in back of the River Street shelter area for literally 16 months. It stood there, a locked field where nothing was being done and people couldn't sleep.
Right.
And people died of exposure and other problems as a consequence of being dispersed from that camp in what I guess activist Dan Hopkins, he's publicly called Mike Rotkin and Scott Kennedy murderers for what they did in that circumstance. And I'm afraid Catherine Byers was not exactly have clean hands in that situation either. And it really, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you follow the debate with Rotkin. Rotkin went into attacking me for being a bad influence on the Santa Cruz community and bad-mouthing certain service providers who I think have been more concerned with getting their checks and getting funded and maintaining a favor with city council members than with furthering the rights of the people that they're supposed to be paid to serve. And I guess, you know, I think, and I thought this a year ago, that it's Rotkin that needs... He needed to be recalled long ago. He needs to be gone from the city council simply for the kind of... I think it's mendacious. I think he uses lies repeatedly. He gives misstatements to the public, and he, even when they're, you know, he's shown that they're lies, he doesn't back off. He is so arrogant that he continues to assert the same lies about, you know, that there's a magnet effect, that there'll be a compassion fatigue effect, that the police don't ticket people except, you know, sparingly, and he, you know, that it's no more problem than a dental.
Right.
I guess you could say that's a value, you know, a value difference rather than a lie. But it is also, I mean, there are a series of misstatements of fact that keep getting repeated, and he knows better.
Well, he's definitely an interesting character, and I almost am in disbelief of what I get impressions of the former Rotkin or something, of what he may have been like. I only know what he is like. And I get interesting stories from even his class students who say, well, he actually, you know, he teaches Marxism on campus, and he will actually use his own actions and use whatever analysis, line of analysis he's using in class to show how his actions at the council are wrong. So that's the kind of contradictions he's living with. You know, he's in an educational setting, and, you know, for whatever purposes he's trying to serve, he's able to use himself as an illustration of what not to do.
Right. Well, I think that he should, maybe he should consider assassinating himself, or perhaps pieing himself. Let's not get too crazy and have
right.
to talk about killing himself. But, you know, I think I'd like to hear what other people think about the Rodkin-Silva debate. You know, who won, who lost, what needs to be put forward. And I guess more important than that debate, what do we do next? I mean, I know that, you know, the shelter, the armory shelter is closed. The weather outside is freezing and wet and cold and miserable. We have a situation where there are 30 spaces for 500 to 1,500 people, and we really have a situation where a lot of people are aware that the situation is wrong, inadequate, and that the city council isn't doing something. And it seemed to me it's the time to start some kind of action downtown. We've talked about this, but I need to hear from the audience out there. Is anybody up for doing something to deal with this situation? Does anybody want to start hitting the phone lines to do some organizing? Give me a call. Let's hear what people have to say about this.
Yeah, I'll let you open up the lines, and I'll be happy to help you on that last point.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Have a good day.
And that was a student against the sleeping ban, and an active one. Well, I wish there were more like him. What do you guys think out there? What do you women think? Free Radio Santa Cruz's Bathrob Spears Broadsides, that's the show you're listening to, wants to know. We're at 427-3772. Give us a call, 427-3772. And while we're waiting for those phone lines to wait up, here's an interview, I mean to light up, sorry. We're going to be giving you some thoughts from a sage and a somewhat crusty political observer, a man who speaks his mind at city. A lot of environmental struggle, and he's been homeless himself, but he gives you sort of his analysis of what the city council did around police review, which was actually, this is a long delayed and repeated phenomenon. There's some sort of, again, largely minor changes in this.